This is listening update, Leo Bustin. This is a course in comprehensive listening, and I feel that I'm qualified to do it because I've been married for over 44 years. And certainly the lament of every parent, every child, every husband, every wife, every teacher, every student, every pastor, every parishioner is this: you have ears, but you do not hear. We have a very serious situation in this. I could go on for the next hour telling you about examples of bad listening. I go back in my own family on this, back in Milltown, just north of Stanwood, where my mother's family came from Norway and settled down there. And there's no doctor in Milltown. I think the population is 5, is what the sign says. But it's a suburb of Stanwood, which has all of 1,000, or 700 maybe. But they had a physician there, and my Uncle Louis, who was the oldest member of my mother's family, I think there were 8 or so in the family, she was next to the oldest. But Uncle Louis had been complaining a lot about trouble with his stomach and other things. All our family have trouble with their stomach, and or associated parts in a way. Louis had gone on for many years. He was by now 65. So somebody convinced him he had to go and see the doctor. I don't know if he'd ever been to a doctor. And of course, in those days, you're probably better off not going to one, but the risk was greater. But he did. He went down and had an appointment with Dr. Gunderson, and he went down to see Dr. Gunderson, and the receptionist told him to strip to the waist. So he took off his pants. So that's so much for my family. My wife often tells us, she's got quite a few psychiatrist stories. One of her favorite ones, and I think very appropriate here, is the day that that these two psychiatrists come into the big medical dental building in a downtown area in a major city. And they knew each other, and they both had offices on the 21st floor. And they happened to go in the elevator same time in the morning. And it was by chance they happened to come together in the evening. It was after 5 o'clock. And the young psychiatrist was really beat. And he'd he just came into the elevator just before it closed. The old psychiatrist was already there. And he took one look at the old psychiatrist and he says, I saw you come in this morning. He says, you look as fresh as you were this morning. He says, how can you go through a day like I've had today, and certainly you must have had a day like it, listening to all these problems of all these people, and still look so fresh? And the old psychiatrist says, who listens? and that's part of our problem. I recall for you from Illusions by Richard Bach. He says, it's not the crowds that wear me. It's the kind of crowd that doesn't care at all about what I came to say. You can walk New York to London on the ocean. You can pull gold coins out of forever and still not make them care, you know. And when he said that, he looked lonelier than I'd ever seen a man still alive. He didn't need food or shelter or money or fame. He was dying of his need to say what he knew. And nobody cared enough to listen. And we see it every day, don't we? And the lady, an old friend, she was downtown, and she met another old friend. And the old friend said, I haven't seen you for a long time. How are things going? The other lady says, well, my husband died last week. He was sick, and he died last week. Well, she said, the other lady says, I hope it wasn't serious. and that's for real. I call up for a reservation. I'm usually flying in or out of Pullman or Spokane or somewhere, and I call up the airlines on an 800 number. It's cheaper that way. I said, this is Leo Bustin, and I need to take a Horizon plane, and I gave her the time and the day, where I was going, and then told her when I was coming back. And then she says, now, what was your name? And what day did you want to go? And what time was that? She asked me all the questions over again, and on several of them, I had to give it 3 times. It turns out that with most people, you have to say it 5 times. She got by with 3. So that's a big problem today. And I've spoken on this subject for very many years. I became interested in the late 40s and early 50s and started looking into literature at that time. And I was very intrigued by some work by Rankin in Ohio. He had the cooperation of a lot of white-collared workers, and he was interested in communication. And he had done like we had did when I was with General Electric Company, and I was with them in the early, in the 50s and into the 60s. And they'd have do surveys in the company where you'd keep track of your time, of how you spent each day. It's a very revealing thing if you're honest about it, and a good discipline. Well, what these people did, what Rankin did, was to get the cooperation of these people over a period of 2 months to keep track of how they spent their time, especially with the emphasis on communication. And it turned out that for these people, about 70% of their day was spent in communication. And the breakdown of this was of great interest to me. About 9% of their day was spent in writing, 15 or 16% in reading, about 28% in speaking, and 45% in listening. Now, this was it really impressed me because I had spent a lot of time in school. I spent half my life in school. And I'd spent a very great deal of time trying to learn how to write and trying to learn how to read, and I had one course in speech. But I'd never had a course in comprehensive listening. And if I call a show of hands here, with especially this older population, there's a very poor chance that you too had you probably did not have a course in comprehensive listening. Now there are a few courses taught in it. But the thing that we should be doing most of, we've never had any disciplinary education in it. And that's very sad. Now, for some people, it's even higher rate than this. As a dean, I spent more time than that in communication and a lot more than 45% in listening. There were two other people that I became interested in the early 50s. And one of them was named Jones at Columbia University. He was he taught psychology. And he was rather disturbed about this, about what was going on as far as how much the students were able to understand what he gave them in his course. He had about 400 students in the course, which is far too many. When I get to be dictator, no class will be over 12, preferably 10. Jesus had 12 and lost one. I figured 10 might be better for us. But Jones became so concerned about it, so what he did was to prepare very, very special lectures that he thought that would be very clear, and then he made out an exam that he felt his class should be able to pass as soon as he had given the lecture. Just by listening to him, they should be able to do very well in it. And this is what he did. And he gave the test right after his lecture. He quit early enough to go through it. And he was shocked to find that there was only a 50% retention of what he thought they should have gotten. And then he waited 2 weeks and gave the same exam. And it was down to 25%. Now, you can't run a business on a 50% efficiency, and you certainly can't do it on 25%. And if it's 25%, roughly half of those are going to be less than 25%. Now, that ought to shake you up. Well, there's a fellow, Nichols, at the University of Minnesota, who also became very interested in listening and communication skills. And he did a lot of very interesting things. But he got a hold, I think, of Jones's work And he was shocked, and he thought, well, maybe it's the students that go to Columbia. So he rounded up, corralled up some of the herring chokers that frequent the University of Minnesota, and he obtained, he didn't do it the way Jones did. He went to some of his friends, and he said, some of his best communicators, and he says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to give 15 minutes of your best lecture. And then I want you to make out an exam that you think they should really be able to complete just at the end of your lecture. And he did this. And he was really shocked when he found out that even with these outstanding lectures and with these brilliant Scandinavian students, there was an average retention of 50%. He didn't wait 2 weeks. And I could have told him this. You just wait 2 days with Scandinavians. And they were down 25%. I could have told him that because, you know, when the Scandinavians came over this country, they couldn't give them an hour's lunch and break because they'd have to re-educate them for what to do in the afternoon. And one of them was an elevator operator, and he flunked out because he forgot the route. These data did not surprise me, because I left General Electric Company and went to the so-called Big Time at the University of California. And I was teaching there, not to the general run of students who came to the University of California on the campus I was. That campus, you had to be in the highest 7% of your graduating class from high school to get in there. But I wasn't teaching them. I was teaching the select of these, the select, the ones that got into veterinary medicine or human medicine. Veterinary medicine was more restrictive, so some of them that couldn't get into veterinary medicine went into medicine. That's true. I'd give them brilliant lectures, follow it by enlightened examinations. And I'd collect up the examinations and go to my home and go into my study and close the door and read the examination questions and answers and weep. The reason I did this, I didn't want my wife to see a grown man cry. Now, what I did then, I felt, well, we got to do something about this. And I took a page out of Nichols's book. But I think I improved upon it. I don't know if he'd think so, but I don't care, and I guess he doesn't either. But what he did was to look at the people that were less than 25%, you see, retention, after a couple of days. And he said, what are their characteristics? And I've modified and added to it. So what I'm now going to do is give you about a dozen characteristics of a bad listener, and you'll recognize them in your friends and probably in the cool of the evening you may even recognize some of them in yourself.
You're not going to test us, are you?
Yes. And the first thing that the bad listener does is to decide the subject is uninteresting and useless and turns the speaker off. Now, the take-home lesson here is that, you know, and you're often trapped in many times in situations where you can't really conveniently get up and leave when the announced subject is like the art of listening. But you can leave anytime you want to. But, and I'll remember it, but you can leave. You should take it as a challenge. Maybe there's something interesting in it for you. G.K. Chesterton, who I quoted the other day because he all those beautiful things he wrote about pigs, I liked him even before that, but then he really cemented the relations with me. But he said that there's no such a thing as an uninteresting subject, just uninterested listeners. So that even if the announced subject is the care of camellias in nuclear attack, No, take it as a challenge and see if there's something you can get out of it. Another thing the bad listener does is wait to deliver a speech carefully rehearsed while listening. You can't do it that way. Or the third one, listens carefully for flaws in the presentation so that at the first opportunity they can clobber the speaker. Can't do it that way either. The fourth one is he or she fails to comprehend nonverbal communication. Now, there's at least three of us here today that are really a leg up on you, because we've spent most of our life learning how to diagnose situations in creatures that can't articulate, because that's what veterinarians do. It's not an unmixed blessing that our patients can't lie to us, but it's something that you have to learn. You learn it from the animals, because the animals read you very well. Somebody made a survey one time, and it was very enlightening to me. I don't know what the population was, but in looking at communication between two people, they said 55% of it was body language. 36% was the sound of the voice, and 9% were words. So this is probably a pretty important area. I learned about this early, as I've shared with some of you, in my marriage, because, as I said, I was married over 44 years ago. And in those days, the wife got up and made breakfast. And for me, that was 5:30 in the morning. And I wake up the chief, and she'd wander usually in the direction of the kitchen. She usually found the kitchen, but that was about the end of it. From there on, it was all downhill. I mean, she'd turn on the right rear burner, put the tea kettle on the front left, and put raisins in my Russian tea. I mean, generally jazzed it up, and I knew that this was inconsistent with a long marriage. And so I made a deal with her, and I said, because I at that time I knew how to cook better than she did, and because I'd done a lot more cooking. And I said, I'll take care of the breakfast. You just stay in bed. Don't get up till I leave. And I never knew for a long time what time she got up. But she always had dinner for me when I came home at 5:30 at night. It's only recently that I learned what time she gets up in the morning, because she now she's lost her hearing, so she has a hearing dog. And of course, we had to train for this. And the dog likes to be kind of programmed in. You can't keep changing the time you want to get up. So you set it, you see, and the dog, you already knows the time, so it's perched, you see, for a takeoff, for an 8-foot leap on the bed, or if it's out with me in the kitchen, it's going to go about 80 miles an hour and take a 12 to 15 foot leap onto the bed on top of her. And that has a way of getting you up. So that's, we made that agreement. So the take home lesson here is that you know, to ask people, you got to study the physiology and understand this. And there are some people that don't operate particularly good in the morning. Some people are better at night. And my chief is that way. I'm no good at night, and that raises other problems, but I'm not going to discuss that. But some people aren't good either morning or night. Now, another thing a bad listener does is to be overcome with facts and detail, making neat outlines and note-taking. I sometimes bring up an example here because I think it's a good one. Except in a few courses, I guess you have to learn some of this fine detail, although you probably forget it if you don't use it shortly thereafter. But you look at concepts, you have concepts and understanding of these things, and then you have this framework you kind of plug it into as you listen. When I was matriculating for my advanced degree at the University of Washington School of Medicine, I'd often sit in with the medical students on certain courses. And I usually pick a place I sit, which was just up a couple of rows and in the end row. And there was a student that usually sat next to me. He was he took his undergraduate degree at Harvard. And he was a bright guy. But he made the neatest outlines and notes that you've ever seen. I take pretty good notes, but I mean, he even measured the indentations, and he got so carried away with this. I think he only got a B out of the court, and he had the capability of getting an A in the course. But he got so concerned, you see, with monkeying around with facts and some of this detail, that he lost the concepts, I think. So don't get wound up in that. As I often say, the only real in medicine, veterinary medicine, we often get hung up on numbers, and we take things out to five significant places, don't we? You know, we say to make it sound really accurate, 22.565%. You know, of a clinical test, where you probably only know it. Maybe it was closer to 1/5, you know, but that's probably stretching a point. The only significant, I think the most significant figure for most people is a woman's age. And that's only good for two significant figures. You don't care whether they're 39 or 39.2. And most of you are. Another thing that the bad listener does is he or she can't cope with periods of silence and use them effectively. Now, I probably attended as many lectures as almost anybody here in a lot of places. And they speak at about the rate I'm going now, which is about 100, 110 words a minute. And probably have three or four pretty good things for 50 minutes. Although most of them speak 55. And now and then they stop and tell you some tired old jokes like I have done here today. They get into a subject that you probably know more than they do about, which I call a cross between a crocodile and an abalone, which is a crocabalone. And I've tried some experiments on this, and when I was dean, I seldom turned down an invitation to speak to a Rotary Club or a Kiwanis Club, because they run the country, see. And I wanted to get to these people because I had some things on my mind I needed. And with these people, they usually put you on at 5 minutes after one. And everybody leaves at 1:30. So whatever you got to say, you better do it in 20 to 25 minutes. And I'd usually have more than that to say, so I was speaking pretty fast. In fact, I was going along about 200 words a minute, because you found out if you go about 200 words a minute, you find out that people pay very close attention because they don't want to miss anything. So you can go along like this for quite a while. And then I'd stop and start fumbling with my papers like I'd lost my place. It's easy for me. I've had a lot of practice with it. And you then study the audience, and you'll find out that they start rubbing their hands and wondering. After about 23 seconds or 30 seconds, the natives become very restless, and they're wondering if the old geezer has had a heart attack or something. The take-home lesson here is that in these periods of crocabalones, and when they have these stuttering moments or they're telling a tired old joke that you heard five times before, you use this time for recapitulation. Now you have gone through four or five points, you see, and when I'm dwelling off on this, you say, no, you know, the first one was this, the second one was this. I was in school for years and years, and had there been a shortcut to learning, I think I would have found it short of recapitulation, using it, reusing it, recapitulation. Had there been one, I think I would have found it. Not yet. I didn't find it. So that's the take-home lesson there. Another thing that the bad listener does is to fake attention. And there are only certain populations that do this. I have to confess that I sometimes do it, and I've done it to my wife. When I was, especially during my busy part of my life, in the last, up until about 3 years ago, for about 10 years, it was sort of night and day, and I'd come home beat with a lot of work yet to do. And the spokesman review hadn't been delivered in the morning when I left. It's a morning paper. So it'd be laying on the table there. And Cronkite, or his replacement that wears a sweater, would be on the tube. Mm-hmm. And here's the chief. She's got something to tell me. And so I'd act like I was listening to her, checking out the headlines in the spokesman review, finding out what terrible things were happening in the world, you know. I was faking it. It reminds me what my Scots Scotsman sheepherder had a sign on his desk: be sincere even if you don't mean it. I was faking it. Well, faking is the wrong way to go. In fact, our daughter Karen, I think that's the worst condemnation she could have on something I had done or something that somebody said or whatever it was, or she was also an artist. You know, faking it was the lowest form of things. Here again, I'm reminded of a story about another psychiatrist. He was had a very busy practice in a large city. And he had already gone through a long day, and it was after 5 o'clock, and he was about to escape out the back door when the receptionist came running out there after him. She says, "You can't go yet. You got to come back. There's a fellow out here that's lowering a snake in a wagon track. You got to hear him out." He says, "Okay." So he came back in. The fellow came in, told him his story. He had a sad story. He was lowering a snake in a wagon track. And we in the health professions are often challenged and come up not only with a diagnosis, but a treatment. And how this guy tied this fellow over till tomorrow. And he had a bright idea, because this psychiatrist was a circus buff. And there was a big circus in town. And he very confidently, you always want to be confident when you're prescribing. He says, "Here's what I want you to do tonight." He says, "There's a great circus in town, a lot of great acts." And he says, "I want you to go down there and take in the acts. But you can't take them all in, and there's one I don't want you to miss, and that's the clown. The greatest clown I've ever seen. Don't forget the clown." Long period of silence. And then his patient said, "I am that clown." A facade is a heavy piece of merchandise to carry. The biggest challenge I had in East Stanwood High School, when they had an East Stanwood High School, we had a lady that was always putting on plays. Huh? And I'd hide. I mean, there was 21 in my class. And she was always short of characters. And she was always trapping me into it. And it's the toughest job there is to play a part. Huh? To be somebody you are not. So don't fake it. Another thing the bad listener does is to tolerate the bad performance of the lecture. Now, that doesn't mean that you necessarily interrupt and point out all the mistakes I've already made here in the first 23 minutes. But we do owe one another the benefit of constructive criticism. Paul told us about that. You do it gently. You do it with warm fuzzies. I don't know if any of the translations have warm fuzzies, but that's what he meant. We do it with warm fuzzies. I often remonstrate with my associates in this area that you can, what you say to another person could well be based on the affirmative answer to three questions. Is it kind? Is it true? Is it necessary? It'll shorten a lot of conversation. I've had some difficulty with it myself, and I have been taken to task many times in my life. Sometimes lose sleep for many nights over it. And at the time, I had to say, well, what they said was true, and I guess it was certainly necessary, but I had trouble with the kind part of it. But what you have to do is take the long look. Huh? And as I look back on it now, they had done me a favor, even though I lost sleep over it. I like C.S. Lewis. I've read most of what he's written. And he said that a friend is not a friend of mine if he doesn't care whether I lie, cheat, and steal. If we really care for somebody, we do care whether they lie, cheat, and steal. So that's the take-home lesson there. Except also, I like another statement that might be appropriate here. C.S. Lewis said, think tough, but love tenderly. Another thing the bad listener does is to shun technical and painstaking listening. What kind of TV programs do you watch? I Dream of Jeannie, Gunsmoke, the Democratic National Convention, the Republican National Convention, Hogan's Heroes, and I was in prison camp and it was nothing like that. They were programs where you didn't really have to make the fifth grade to understand them. Maybe the fourth, but not the fifth. And you can't learn comprehensive listening that way, to listening to a bunch of inane stuff. You gotta really concentrate. And I've had this really impressed on me in recent times, because now that my wife has lost her hearing, and she reads lips, and she has some devices that help. But if you have a conversation with her, and she really has to concentrate on it, 20 or 25 minutes pretty much does her in. I mean, you're fatigued by that time. Another thing the bad listener does is to let emotional words throw them. Now, I don't know what your hang-ups are, but I bet I could go through 20 words here now and I'd lose most of you. I'll tell you one that really gets me. In our home in Snooze Hill, where I was growing up, in our living room we had a picture of Leif Erikson discovering America. I knew he did that. And you know what they taught me when I got to school? I had to learn it. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, discovered America. He discovered America. He was a Johnny-come-lately, 500 years before my forefathers were here. But they made me do this, you see. And every time they brought it up, it was emotional reaction with me. I mean, terrible. In fact, on Columbus Day, I send out Leif Erikson cards. I hope you do, too. So don't fight the feeling. Don't let emotional words throw you. Another thing the bad listener does is to fail to comprehend that there's no such a thing, that every person is unique, that there's no such a thing as an average person. If you know an average person, there's only one of them. And C.S. Lewis had something to say about this too. He said, there are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal, and their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. But it is the immortals whom we joke with, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal horrors or everlasting splendors. All day long we are in some degree helping each other to one or another of these destinations. And that's a heavy. That's a heavy. Another thing the bad listener does is to question for victory rather than clarification. It's a one-upmanship game, isn't it? Between professor and student, student, professor, husband, wife. A lot of marriages went down the tubes this way because they really weren't communicating. I know one couple they had they were having trouble in a very relatively short time after marriage. They fortunately went to the pastor. He suggested a very good counselor, and the counselor was very short time diagnosing their situation. In effect, he said, here's what I want you to do over the next 2 weeks, and then you come back and see me. Whenever one of you says anything more complicated than pass the salt, which you shouldn't do in a way, the other one should repeat what do you think the other one said. And they were laughing sort of tragically because they realized they really weren't communicating. So the take-home lesson there is you question only for clarification, not for victory. It isn't a one-upmanship game. Another thing the bad listener does is to criticize the speaker for ineptness, appearance, or the way they talk or the way they dress. And some of you are looking at me, you know, what does that old geezer think, he's going on a safari or something? Well, I like this coat. My wife gave it to me. It's got a lot of pockets, and I got a lot of stuff to carry around in pockets. If somebody came running through that door right now and said, get out of this rat nest, it's on fire, I wouldn't say, couch that in better rhetoric. I'd get out of here. I understood him. Now, I have an unusual tie on today. People always ask me, they remember me for two things, my ties and my pigs. I've used this tie's made a lot of money for a lot of causes. I usually charge the bankers $50 a minute, and some of them are foolish enough to pay it. Most of you, if you wear ties yet, most people have given up on ties, because if you analyze it, can you think of something more worthless than a tie? It costs money. It doesn't warm your belly. All it does is catch gravy and soup. And then if you're going to not be a slob, you got to get it cleaned, and that costs money. Wastes resource. So I invented this long time ago. In fact, my wife made it for me. I had several of these. In fact, the students gave me a bow tie this big. It's got a zipper in it. Had a cookie when they came. But you see, this is a tie that's big enough. It's got a zipper in it. And it's got notes that I'm going to call to your attention. And in these years now, you've noticed it even here to an extent. But, you know, they don't have desserts very much here. I like something sweet, you know, after meal. I got them in here. I'm going to have that. Right after lunch, I see I got some peanuts in here. And you see, it's big enough also to carry a sandwich. So that if you go and talk to the Weight Watchers Club for lunch, you got a place to put your sandwich, you see. Sometimes I carry rice cookies in here. And so it's handy. And if you do it right, you see, you can drop your soup and gravy in here and then just zip it up. And it saves a lot of cleaning. Now, there's another thing I should tell you about this. Is that the bane of my existence has been cocktail parties. And if you wear this tie to a cocktail party, before the night is out, somebody will come up to you and put his arm around you and say, hey, buddy, the fly on your tie is half open. Well, why did I go through all this for you on this last point? The point is this. When you go to hear a lecture, you go there for probably several reasons that are legitimate. You go there for edification, to learn something that you didn't know before. Or you go there also for humor, to get a laugh, because that's probably our best therapy today. And you can probably think of a few more legitimate reasons. The illegitimate reasons are to make judgment on the speaker. to criticize him for their language, and I don't speak English that well. My excuse is I learned another language before the one I'm speaking to you now. I don't know what your excuse is, but that's a pretty good excuse. So what you go there, you even if they stutter and stammer, they may have something to say to you, and you don't go there to judge whether they bought something on from Goodwill or some bargain basement. You go there for information, edification, or for fun. Now, I wanted to make a point here, that often made by my friend, on listening and watching and responding to people, and in what we say to people, we spend most of our time in infirming rather than affirming, don't we?
Couldn't get that word.
We infirm, we don't affirm. It's usually criticism. Huh? We usually criticize, don't we? We infirm people. You send them to the infirmary by what you say to them, rather than affirming them. And here, the dogs are very important. At one time, I was the chief beagler for 1,000 beagles. And we had a lot of beagles that had little beagles. And I've watched a lot of mother dogs with their little pups. And it's interesting to observe them, because the mother dog usually licks, comforts, and affirms the pups. Maybe 9 times out of 10. Maybe the 10th time she might growl a little bit and remonstrate with them. But it's usually a percentage of 9 out of 10 when it's an affirming, supporting thing. In my more limited observations on Homo sapiens, the reverse seems to be true. They bite and gnaw and chew and infirm them 9 times out of 10. And I think the dog, in this case, has the best plan. Now, there is another dimension to this that I want to now discuss. And in my notes here, it says an old Native American proverb states that keep silent or your tongue will make you deaf. That's pretty good. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who you always hear a lot about in this country, and was truly a remarkable person, and he went back to Germany rather than staying here during the war, and certainly one of the great theologians of this century in the eyes of many, was a pacifist. And he said that the most important thing that you can do for your brother and your sister in the fellowship is to listen to them. And by that he meant a brother and a sister in a universal sense. And he's right. Now, John Godfrey understood this. He spent his life as a mediocre lawyer in a town. He was an immigrant's son. And he wanted to be something else, but his folks said, "No, John, you're going to be a lawyer." So he became a lawyer. He did a reasonable job. He bought some land in the town. The town built around him. And he got very old. His wife had died, and he was about time to quit. And so he had accumulated a good deal of resource. So he thought he should help out town. So he bought, he had a good piece of ground, and he contracted with the best architect and built this very beautiful structure. And a lot of people wondered what the old geezer was up to. And he wouldn't tell them until the day of dedication, when a sign went over the door of this very beautiful building. It said, "The man who listens." And by way of explanation at the dedication, John Godfrey said this: One of the most terrible aspects of this world today is that nobody listens to anyone else. If you are sick or even dying, nobody listens. If you are bewildered or frightened or lost or bereaved or alone or lonely, nobody really listens. Even the clergy are hurried and harassed. They do their best and work endlessly, but time has taken on a fragmented character. It doesn't seem to have any substance any longer. Nobody has time to listen to anyone, not even those who love you and would die for you. Your parents, your children, your friends, they have no time. That's a very terrible thing, isn't it? Whose fault is it? I don't know. Now, these are really the words of Taylor Caldwell in her novel, The Listener. But you don't have to go to real life. I mean, you don't have to go to fiction to get this. You can go to real life, huh? And I'll give it to you from real life for a couple of them. The first one is from one of my favorite writers. It's from, let me get on something I can read better with. I don't like trifocals. I think I have to go to quadrifocals. Is there such a thing? I'll have to invent them, I guess. This is from If Life is a Bowl of Cherries, What Am I Doing in the Pits? It's from Irma Bombeck. And she described an experience in which, and I can really sympathize with her and empathize. It was one of these days, I mean, everything's happening, and she's got to get out to the airport and go off somewhere. And she's got everything piled up. And she finally finishes it and takes off for the airport. Well, the traffic was a lot less than it usually was. She got into the airport, parked her car. She went up. There weren't too many waiting in line. And she got to her gate, and it was a half hour before plane time. Great. She sat down. She'd been trying to read this book for a long time, a very interesting novel, and so she started reading this book. And pretty soon, a voice next to her, belonging to a very old lady, said, "I'll bet it's cold in Chicago." Stone-faced Irma said, "It's likely." And the lady continued, "I haven't been in Chicago for nearly 3 years. My son lives there." "That's nice," said Irma Bombeck, still looking at the book. The lady continued, "My husband's body is on this plane. We've been married for 53 years. I don't drive, you know, and when he died, a nun drove me from the hospital. And we aren't even Catholics. The funeral director let me come to the airport with him." Irma then continues, "I don't think I've ever detested myself more than I did at that moment. Another human being was screaming to be heard, and in desperation had turned to a cold stranger who was more interested in a novel than a real-life drama occurring right at her elbow. All she's needed was a listener. No advice, experience, or wisdom, money. Just a minute or two to listen to her." And she then went on, she said she talked numbly and steadily until we boarded the plane, and then found her seat in another section. And as I hung up my coat, I heard her plaintive voice say to her seat companion, "I'll bet it's cold in Chicago." "And I prayed," said Irma, "please God, let her listen." Another one. This is from Robert Raines, who you've heard referred to here at Holden probably many times, from his Creative Brooding. And this is a letter it's entitled "Too Busy to Listen." "Dear folks, thank you for everything, but I'm going to Chicago to try to start some kind of a new life. You asked me why I did those things and why I gave you so much trouble. The answer is easy for me to give you, but I'm wondering if you will understand. Remember when I was about 6 or 7 and I used to want you to just listen to me? I remember all the nice things you gave me for Christmas and my birthday, and I was really happy with the things about a week at the time that I got the things. But the rest of the time and during the year, I really didn't want presents. I just wanted all the time for you to listen to me like I was somebody who felt things too, because I remember even when I was young, I felt things. but you said you were so busy. Mom, you're a wonderful cook, and you had everything so clean, and you were so tired from doing all those things that made you so busy. But you know something, Mom? I would have liked crackers and peanut butter just as well if you'd only sat down with me for a while during the day and said, tell me all about it so that maybe I can help you understand. And when Donna came, I didn't understand why everyone made so much fuss, because I didn't think it was my fault that her hair is curly and her skin's so white. She doesn't have to wear glasses with such thick lenses either, does she? And her grades were better too, weren't they? If Donna ever has any children, I hope you will tell her just to pay some attention to the one who doesn't smile very much, because that one will really be crying inside. And when she's about ready to bake 6 or 7 dozen cookies, to make sure first the kids don't want to tell her about a dream or a hope or something, because thoughts are important too to small kids, even though they don't have so many words to use when they tell you about what's inside of them. I think that all the kids that were doing so many things that grown-ups are tearing out their hair worrying about are really looking for somebody that will have time to listen a few minutes and really and truly will treat them as they would a grown-up, who might be useful to them, you know, or polite to them. If you folks had ever said to me, pardon me when you interrupted, I'd have dropped dead. If anybody asks you where I'm going, tell them that I've gone looking for somebody with time, because I've got a lot of things to talk about. Signed, love to all, your son. It was a boy with a record of juvenile delinquency. Now, I'm going to give it to you with only one comment. To listening to someone gives them a feeling of self-worth, which is a very important commodity today. Now, I close with a very moving story. From a friend, and you'll know at the end why I bring it up today. But it's appropriate here. Part of our take-home lesson is that we take time out to listen to those who are hard to listen to. And one of the places that I've mentioned already, I guess in probably 2 lectures, is a place called Bethel or Bethel in Bielefeld, West Germany. It's probably the most remarkable place I've ever been. When Carol and Mary Hinderly visited there many years ago, they came back and says, it's the nearest thing to the kingdom of God they had ever seen. And then my dear friend Edna Hong also was there. Some of you have seen her books here. She's written a lot of bestsellers. One of them was Bright Valley of Love, which is about Bethel. It's a moving story. And it moved me, and one of my interests, as you all know, is how animals are used to help people, and people, of course, helping animals. And I was interested in Bethel because she mentioned this in her book. And so I was very interested to go there. And one summer, in fact, his tapes are still here, Alex Funky. He was director at that time of Bethel, and he was up here at the village. And he was a prisoner of war of the Americans when I was a prisoner of war of the Germans. And we compared notes, and he had the best deal. But he invited me to come and visit there. And many times when I was in Europe, I took a weekend off. I was consulting for the Surgeon General of the Air Force, and I went up to Bielefeld, took the train from Hanover, and went to Bethel, and was warmly welcomed there. It's called An Institution Without Walls. In fact, there's a movie out by the Latham Foundation, which I helped to make, about this, about the place, and it's called Institution Without Walls. And they showed me a lot of things out in the country and in town. And it was obvious that there was one person that they didn't want me to miss, and that was in House Ebenezer. They wanted me to meet Rickard. And I was there, they were having dinner, and I was upstairs with my hosts, who were showing me where some of the patients lived. And the group had come out of the kitchen, or out of the dining room, and they were all out there, lame and halt and blind, and they don't have very many blind people there. But the thing that caught my eye was this fellow in a gurney. Let's turn that on, and I'll tell you when to flick the upper switch there. All right, you can turn around, and this is House Ebenezer, and this is Rickard. Rickard is a spastic, cerebral palsy. He's born that way. He's been flat on his back for his entire life. He has boxing gloves on so that he won't hurt himself because he does not have control of his voluntary muscles. And he caught sight of me and hollered out. And he's one of these people that grimaces when he talks. And it's hard to watch. In fact, if you saw him there, you'd probably exit this way. Well, he hollered out and said, "Who's that?" I told him it was somebody from America. And he became very excited because people from America had helped him. And then he said, and then he found out I was a veterinarian. And he became very excited because he had a lot of questions for me. Do you ever work on birds? Are you ever able to make them fly again if they have broken wings? How do you give therapy to fish? And so the question went. His last question was, "Do you employ any Indians in your school of veterinary medicine?" Well, we have Native American, we also have Indians. So I said yes. Well, he was pleased about that. And so I said goodbye to Rickard, and I maintained correspondence with him. And when I walked away, I asked my host, that was an unusual question. Did he mean Native Americans or did he mean Indians from India? Because Native Americans were very popular at that time in West Germany. No, he says he meant Indians from India. You see, he's very supportive of some children in India. In fact, one of them is studying to become a teacher. And I wasn't sure I heard him right. Because how can this fellow, laying there with no control of his voluntary muscles, help children in India? He says, "Well, one thing I failed to tell you is that he has control of his right foot. And some years ago, he learned to paint beautiful pictures with his right foot and using a mirror." Next slide. Here he is. You see his boxing gloves? Maybe we can turn the lights off. Will you turn the lights off, please, someone? Here he is. It's not in color. But here he is laying on his back, looking at the mirror, and with his foot, you see, he's painting. In the next slide, then, we'll show. Then they'd cut these up into kind of postcard size and sell them. I have many of them. And I have some of his pictures on my bulletin board, and a picture of him painting. And when I think I got problems, I really don't have problems. Now, the story doesn't end there, because Fritz von Vogelschwing was in charge of Beethoven from 1911 until 1946 when he died. And his father before him, started in 1867, his father took over, I think, in 71. They were both really geniuses, did a fantastic thing there. There's over 5,000 people who are disadvantaged, over 5,000 people take care of them in some of the most remarkable facilities you've ever seen. Research facilities and everything. But you see, during the war, Hitler put out the order that all people less than human would be put to death. And Fritz von Vogelschwing was very concerned about this because he was studying the obituary columns in some of these other places where they had so-called less than humans. And the obituary column was getting longer. Now, this was very critical to him because these were his children. And he loved them dearly. And he refused to fill out the forms that they required, so they came and filled out the forms. And he appealed to the high command. He got an unsatisfactory letter, as I recall, from Hermann Göring. And one day, Hitler's personal physician, Dr. Brandt, came there with his entourage to make the arrangements. And von Bolschwing staged it very well, and I won't go into all of it. But here's the story they told me. Von Bolschwing got Dr. Brandt off to the side. And he said, "Now just what do you mean by a person, you know, being less than human? What makes them human?" He says, "Their ability to communicate." He says, "Well, Dr. Brandt, I'd like to have you go with me to House Patmos, where our worst cases are." And he took him there. And I don't know all those he showed him. Probably Henrietta, who was hydrocephalic, epileptic, retarded, asleep when they arrived. So Bolschwink went up, stroked her on the head, called her by name. She woke, saw von Bolschwing, big smile on her face, because she knew him, because he spent a lot of time there, because he learned a lot from him. In fact, his philosophy was, the patients are the professors. He also learned a great deal from Otto. Otto knew only about four things. But he knew food, and von Bolschwing never knew a person who enjoyed food more than him. He should be at Holden, but he never knew anyone like Otto. And Otto really appreciated bright colors more than anybody he'd ever knew. And he also knew von Bolschwing. And so he went down the line. And then he finished, and he finally turned to Dr. Brandt, and he says, "Although I can understand that you may not be able to communicate with these people, but it should be obvious to you that we communicate with them." Bonnie turned and walked back to headquarters, followed by Dr. Brandt. And on arriving back at headquarters, Dr. Brandt turned to his entourage and says, "We have ceased negotiations on our returning to Berlin. And I'm here to tell you that no one, including my friend Rickard, was harmed during the war in Bethel." As Carol Hinderly says, that's where Hitler lost the war. Because most of Germany knew what went on there, you see. And there were always provisions, although the state did not support it. There was always provisions at the front door. Why? Because somebody and a lot of people, a lot of compassionate, loving people, took time to listen to those who are hard to listen to. And that's all of our assignment. And I tell you now, because I have a heavy heart as I tell you this, because just 2 days before I came here, I got the notice that Rickard died. He had died, and I had just sent him birthday greetings on July 5th, and he died at the end of July, and the message just got to me.